made a video of Drew Holiday, his defensive technique. And what I saw was the idea of a deep defensive stance. I used to call it the universal athletic position. That's all I'd ever taught, is that to defend, you need to get low. That's the key. Low man wins. You're quicker when you're lower. Yeah, I was wrong about that, because it depends. It depends.
Welcome to Slapping Glass, where we explore basketball's best ideas, strategies, and coaches from around the world. Today, we're excited to welcome former NBA assistant with the Pelicans, Grizzlies, and Warriors, as well as owner of HoopsMind.com, Joe Boylan. Coach Boylan is here today to discuss developing off-the-court skills like emotional control, mindfulness, and meditation, the details of effective on-ball defenders, including Drew Holiday's float step, and we return to the always fun, overrated or underrated. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. Follow us for daily detailed breakdowns on Twitter and YouTube, and subscribe to our Sunday morning newsletter, where we consolidate and break down much of the best that we've seen from around the world of basketball. And now, please enjoy our conversation with Coach Joe Boylan. Want to dive in with a book that I know you've taken a lot from, and we both have as well, and that's the book Range by David Epstein, and talking about the difference between being a generalist or specializing in certain things. And we thought this was a really interesting place to start with you as it pertains to both player development and coaching development. And so I guess we'll start with your thoughts on that book, some of the, what you took out of it, and then how that applies to what you do now as a trainer and all of that.
Yeah, it was a great book, super powerful for me. My path definitely has been unorthodox. I definitely have been emptying water trays and doing laundry and driving buses on my way to try and find a path into coaching at the professional level. So to me, it was reassuring in a lot of ways. And I think when you look at coaches like Nick Nurse, Chris Finch, these guys who have coached overseas, they've coached, you know, in the D League, they've coached all of these different types of situations. And then you look at how creative they are once they get to the job that they're supposed to end up in. And he's playing a box and one in the NBA Finals. And we think, man, that guy is so creative and outside the box. And, you know, it's his experiences and, you know, what some people would categorize as failures as, you know, the toolbox that he can use now that he finally got to, you know, his ultimate destination. So for me, that's really inspiring. I look at that as having the head start isn't necessarily the final say in how things turn out. So it really contextualized a lot of my own experiences. And I think I'm able to better communicate those two, even with players as they go through struggles or, you know, when they're not at the level that they want to be at. You know, you can look at all these things that are, you know, I think he says specialists do better in kind domains with specific rules. And, you know, the wicked domains are where it requires you to be a problem solver. And, you know, all these struggles and stuff that you go through give you more problem solving abilities. So, you know, I've recommended it to more people than I can remember. It's just something where I think for most people, you know, it really, really resonates with.
You know, you hear all the time too that coaches, they live in the film room, they're always watching film. But as it relates to this book and kind of, like you said, training creativity and maybe avoiding like the monotony of thought, what is your response to just constantly watching film? And what are other ways maybe coaches can, again, diversify or maybe broaden their horizons that can translate to work success?
That's a great question. I think that one, you want to be able to connect to the players outside of basketball. There's a depth in your relationship to them when you're able to relate about whatever it is, being a dad, NFL football, you know, WWF you used to watch as a kid, or I mean, anything. There's all these things that humanize you, that connect you, that build trust. So yeah, I think when your only interest is in basketball as a coach, I think we've kind of put that on a pedestal, like these, the grinder and the, you know, the coach that always has the light on in his office. And there's obviously a lot to be said for people that are dedicated and work hard, but giving yourself those times to disconnect. I mean, really, there's the science behind why great ideas happen to us in the shower. You know, when we finally give ourselves a moment to think about things, that's when we can come up with more creative, broader thoughts. And I think even in just our normal technologically, we have this smartphone computer at our fingertips at all times, and we're just always turned on. I think having those, scheduling those moments to do something different, to, you know, engage in a totally different activity. And then I think too, it then ends up teaching you these lessons that are applicable in basketball. I think obviously I've found that from the mindfulness stage, you know, my own journey through meditation and doing these things is also given me a relationship to that beginner's mind, where you have to remember too, that your students don't know the things that you're teaching them the way that you do. And we get disconnected from how we felt when we were first learning these things, because it's all second nature to us now. So in doing and learning new things, it's easier for you to understand, oh yeah, things are a little bit hard at first, especially when you don't understand the language or the fundamental principles that go behind them. So for coaching, I think those really, you know, improve your mental models, which is, you know, how you can help, again, problem solve and troubleshoot, because all players are different and all situations are different. So, you know, you need to be able to come up with novel solutions sometimes.
You hit on a lot of good points there. And I think one of them I want to kind of tie back to is, how during the season can you continue to look at what other people are doing, maybe outside of basketball, or read, or, you know, stay open to other stuff, you know, in the middle of the year? I mean, summertime, off season, coaches can get more into those things, but do you try, or did you try to do that, you know, while you're in the middle of the season?
Yes, I did. I mean, I have, you know, I have an hour blocked out every day strictly for my personal development. And that's, I have to do that. I have to read every day. I have to learn something every day. I have it on a checklist. One of my daily habits, and it's helped me tremendously in reading a lot. Even though I don't read a lot every day, it's just I read a little every day, and sometimes it turns into a lot because it's just a habit that I have to open the book, to turn a page. And you know, that just reduces the friction of what am I going to read. It's just, it's always something. As soon as I finish the book, I have the next one. So yeah, just reading is key, you know, trying to be a lifelong learner. I mean, I remember watching a TED talk on a conductor and the purpose of a conductor, and how the conductor, what he does and how he brings people into check, and how does a conductor manage to keep all of these different instruments and people all in rhythm and doing what he says, and that, you know, adjusting the tempo on the fly. And it is really mind-boggling to think about how he does it. And then it went into his mannerisms. What did he do that, you know, elicited these responses from these different musicians? And it was completely 100% relatable to my own job, to what I thought about and did when I went on the court, you know, that day at practice. I was thinking about the impact of communication, how sometimes with just a look, you can get way more done than saying all these different words and using all this, your vocabulary to describe something. And it's just different ideas. I mean, and that's not the best example, yeah. But there's just so many things that I took along the way. And I don't think that it can be a seasonal thing. I think it's got to be something that, you know, you do all the time.
You've said it a couple of times now too. And I think it's an interesting point that the world of coaching and meditation, I like to ask you about that, the meditation part, what you've learned and then how that affects and goes into your coaching.
Yeah, it's a great practice. And it's something, again, that I'm trying to continue to get better at, and partly because I definitely feel and see the benefits of the awareness I have of my surroundings. of my responses, you know, creating that space between the emotion and my response. And if I don't practice, how am I going to improve? I want to practice what I preach. If I'm going to tell a player that, hey, how can you expect to get better defensively if we're not working on defense in practice? If in your individual player development, we spend an hour on offense and 0 minutes on defense, how are you going to get better on defense? So if I say that, and then I want to have better emotional control, I want to perform better in pressure situations, and I don't practice equipping myself with tools that are going to allow me to do that, then I think that's a little bit hypocritical. I have to do things that are going to improve, you know, my mindfulness, my awareness, my preparedness. So it's very useful for me because I'm a very emotional person. I was a trash talking player, you know, starting fights, getting punched during games, flopping, trying to take 5-6 charges a game. I mean, the worst. I mean, it's embarrassing. I can't even stand to watch myself on film from college just because I just messed the game up with my antics. And referees had total control. Every call had a response. I mean, it was, I had no control. And I mean, and it, that definitely, I never changed. You know, I become a coach, I'm still the same person. I'm still easily distracted by refs. I'm still easily angered by players. And a couple of times those things almost didn't end well for me. So, you know, you start to figure out that, okay, this emotion is useful, of course, in spots, but it has to be by choice. And so, yeah, I mean, even just me playing pickup basketball and not wanting to be that guy that's ruining the game by, you know, calling fouls and saying you're out of bounds when you're not out of bounds. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of an environment that was about elevating your opponent and elevating yourself by getting the best out of your opponent, you know, which I got out of the Inner Game of Tennis. I, you know, this book changed my life about how I competed as a player. But yeah, to circle back to how meditation improved my coaching and the effects that I've had with doing that is, yeah, an awareness to your breath. And it's also spilled over into just in the moment when you're coaching, you can be more present. You can be more aware that you're worried about what you're going to eat for dinner, or you have to pick up your kids after practice, or that this guy didn't tie his shoes when he walked onto the court, and this it's already happened and it's gone, but it's still lingering in your mind. Now I have the awareness to say, not now, thoughts, not now. I'll handle that when it's time to handle that after this practice. I only have 60 minutes with this player, so I have to make the most of every one of them. And then afterwards, when I have the time, I can reconcile these other things that, you know, aren't as important in that moment. So I just prioritizing the moment that you're in, that's what meditation is to me. And that's useful in everything.
Sticking on meditation for a second, what are some like actual ways, I guess, that coaches can use meditation to help them? Like, is it before a game, taking 5 minutes to lie down and breathe, or after practice, or, you know, what are some specific ways that, because I think sometimes you say to coaches, hey, you got to meditate. And it's like, well, I don't know how, I don't know when, I don't know where, how long, all that sort of stuff. So what do you use that's useful?
There's two really good things that I'll respond to with that. One is, once I started doing these visualizations, these guided imageries for players about situations they were going to be in the games, and I started trying to bring coaches in, you know, giving them some ideas of, hey, I don't know what you're doing with your players, but this is something I've found beneficial. A lot of them said, make one for me. I wish I would have, before close game, would have gone through my late game timeout in my head before. And so that's what I did. I just wrote and recorded a few coaching, you know, pressure situations or things going wrong. And literally, it's just repackaging, taking the time to think out, what are you going to say to the team at halftime when they're not playing well? What are you going to say after a disappointing loss? What are you going to say when, you know, a player loses his cool and gets a technical foul? There's a lot of situations that are going to necessitate a response from you. If you've already gone over it in your head, just like these players going over the situation, like Michael Jordan saying, I could do it because I had already done it before in my head. It was easy the second time around. It's the same thing for you as a coach, going through seeing a run and being mindful and calling the timeout, just practicing that, whether that's through a guided imagery, whether that's through setting an intention for your meditation. Hey, I'm going to take this 10 minutes to play my Headspace app, and my intention is going to be returning to my focus after a player's upset me or the ref's upset me. You could apply it in that way, I think, for sure. And then the other way is just planning your sessions, being mindful of mistakes that could happen either in yourself explaining the things or what the player may potentially make when you're working on something. And this is in this book I just read, A Coach's Guide to Teaching. And he talks about taking the time before a session to write down errors you think might happen and what your response is going to be to those errors. And so that does a bunch of things. One, it primes you to look for it. So now once you're on the court with the player, you've been primed to look for these things that you think might go wrong. And then if they do go wrong, or if anything goes wrong, you've depersonalized their failure, their inability to do what you've asked. It's no longer a reflection of, oh, he's not getting it. Like, that's a reflection of me or a reflection of his focus or concentration. It could just be that the drill created error. And so it depersonalizes it for the coach. So there's all these residual benefits of mindful planning. You know, maybe that is maybe you don't know what meditation is. You don't know how to start. It might just be taking mindful minutes to plan and reflect on your session, or plan and reflect on what you're going to say to, you know, your team or a certain player. You know, I worked with a coach who would go on the court before he talked to the team in the mornings. He'd get there early. He'd take his piece of paper. He'd go out on the court where he'd actually be, and he would narrate what he was going to go through in the shoot around before anybody ever showed up. And, you know, that gave him confidence that he was more prepared and that his delivery would, you know, oh, don't forget this. He strengthened the connection between what he wanted to have happen and his performance. So those are a couple of different practical ways that any coach, whether you think that meditation is for you or not, you know, what I tell players is there's these Forbes articles about how all the CEOs of every Fortune 500 company reports that they have a meditation practice. Some ridiculously high percentage have meditation practice. So I just say to the players, yeah, the wealthiest executives in the world, they all take time out of their day to practice this, but it's probably nothing. You probably would get nothing out of it. I'll keep doing it. I'm going to definitely copy them. But if you don't want to, I understand. You guys, you're much smarter than all those people. And then they say, well, that's a good point. If all these people are doing it and saying it's beneficial and they're giving their time, which, I mean, when you're talking about guys making $20 million, how valuable is their time? And that's kind of my pitch to the guys is that let's just copy these super successful people's habits and then see after some practice if you take any benefit out of it.
When you mentioned that, you know, you knew a coach who would come in and he would, you know, be an organizer and writing out the practice plan and trying to see where things could go wrong. I think it's on topic a little bit, but me and Dan had previously a conversation about coaches who maybe write out the practice plan for the players to see, like before the practice, or huddle them up and kind of talk through the practice with them. What are the benefits do you feel from that, if any, as far as just maybe taking away the stress or the anxiety, maybe the players not knowing, but then kind of, like we said, showing them or talking about it?
I think that it has benefits. I think you're just adding cognitive load to the uncertainty. If you don't know how long you're going to be doing something, that's something else to think about instead of executing the skill or the tactic. So yeah, I like it as an idea. I like giving the players the schedule, the time. So, I mean, because players are going to budget their energy. And if they don't know how long they're going to be doing something, I think you're less likely to get max effort from them if that's what's being required. So I think it gives them some autonomy and control over, okay, this is what we're doing. I know that. Now I don't have to worry about it and think about it. And I can kind of give more focus and attention to the task, which is the most important thing possible for learning. So yeah, anything that clears players' minds, I'm for. Anything at all. I know from player feedback that they do like that. They like to know what the session's going to look like and feel like.
Joe, kind of connecting these two points a little bit. So you know, right now we're talking a lot about de-stressing, mindfulness, you know, taking pressure off of coaches and athletes and finding ways to do that. But then also there needs to be to build resilience and to build a team or a player that can respond to stressful situations. There also needs to be practice with stress on it and putting them in constraints or difficult situations. So then how do you then build into your training areas where now you're putting a lot of pressure on them and making them perform under that pressure?
That's a great point. I think that those are not mutually exclusive things. I think that you want to be present in the moment, especially the ones that are high pressure and competitive and have stakes on them. So I totally agree. If you want to perform well under pressure, put a scoreboard up in practice every day and have the clock ticking down and have guys have opportunities with lower stakes to experiment, make mistakes, but also have success and build confidence too. So yeah, I think that that's spot on. You have to practice pressure. You have to practice desirable difficulty. To be engaging, things need to be challenging anyways. But just, I think, from the pressure situation, from navigating emotional control. I mean, I've heard every coach that I've ever worked for or played for say the phrase, next play. Say, move on to the next play. I've heard it from everyone. And, you know, it's such a expression that we know what we want to see out of the player, but how often is that moment practiced? Saying it is great, but are we, one, equipping them with tools to do that? So do they even understand that there is something going on when a mistake happens that is a response is taking place? And then two, do we give them the environment to work on improving it? And so the only way that I think you can do that is by prodding and poking at their emotional control. It's being the ref and making unfair calls against them intentionally. It's changing the rules and changing the score to make things more difficult for that player. There's all these different ways you can irk players. And then once you do, then you can use the practice situation to bring attention to it. Hey, look at your response. Think about how you're feeling. This is the same thing that happens in the game. This can't go on for longer than you allow it to let on. You can be upset about this, but does it serve you to be upset about it now? So I think, you know, just creating those environments where you can have those conversations, where you can bring attention to the actual feeling of it, because you can say those things, but one, it's hard to learn anything just by somebody telling you. But two, I think you have to kind of almost have lost control to have that awareness be brought to your attention. You know, and even still, I mean, I've done this with players repeatedly and haven't necessarily had great success in improving it either. So I think, you know, obviously, just like anything else, there has to be a level of attention and focus from the player, intention too, about wanting to improve this. But yeah, I think that creating an environment that is constantly keeping score. And so one, it just lowers the stakes. It just creates more opportunities to fail, more opportunities to succeed, more opportunities to build up that, okay, I missed it. It's not the end of the world. Or I made it and it feels great. I really want to make it again.
Coach, what role does the head coach play in developing this next play mentality in regards to if you blow a rotation and you know the coach is going to lose it? Or, you know, so then that obviously takes you out of the player, maybe out of like, he can't really move on because he knows his coach is going to either maybe pull him out, or he knows the coach's reaction is also putting the stress on him of this not getting over the play and moving on.
Yeah. And that's in this book I just read by Doug Lemov, and it's exactly right. You have to create an environment of error. It is on the head coach to do that, because if you're going to, yeah, if a mistake means you're coming out of the game, then you're not going to create a next play mentality. They're going to know there is no next play. I'm coming out if I mess up. You have to definitely create the environment where making mistakes is tolerated. It's encouraged. It's the only way for creativity to happen. So you have to say, you know, we're going to take aggressive mistakes. Now, there are mistakes that we're going to that we're going to have a standard against, but there's also going to be mistakes that we're going to have a standard for. And so it's not outcome based, it's process based. And so that I think that he's critical. Without him, you can, like you said, you can practice it all day. If it's not backed up by what actually happens in the game, I think that there's a major disconnect.
Joe, with building resilience to stress, you know, we talk about players having resilience and we talk about, you know, kind of individuals, but how about from a more of like a team standpoint? What are ways that the head coach can help the entire organization or the entire team handle stressful situations or move on from a tough loss? So I guess less interpersonally, but more as from the organizational level.
Yeah, I think, you know, one question I think that should be asked in job interviews of the coach to the management is, how do you expect us to respond after a loss? What is the environment supposed to look like? If it's losing is the end of the world, and, you know, we're going to be, if we lose and don't play well, we're going to be buttoned up and it's going to be serious and we're going to just, you know, lock in on these mistakes and we're going to handle it in this very business-like approach, then that's what you do. If you're going to say that we're going to create an environment of, you know, mistakes are okay, that this is growth mindset and we're not going to get too high, get too low, we're going to do the same thing every time. If music is on, you know, in the weight room before a game that we lose, music has got to be on the next day as well. You know, you have to have that consistency. And I think that it is an interesting dichotomy of what we preach again a lot, that don't get too high, don't get too low, have emotional stability, don't read your press clippings, don't listen to your critics. And so I think that those things are important. How you respond to those are really, really important for how your overall group is going to respond to adversity is, you know, and from the coach, what example does the coach set on the sideline? He can have a major calming influence if he's able to be in the moment and emotionally stable and not responding. How can he set the example? That does trickle down. You see a lot of times players come out and say, that huddle, I looked at coach and he was calm and looked at us and explained what we needed to do. And I guess it kind of goes back to that mindfulness and being prepared and having emotional control. Those things are beneficial, not just for players to your point, but also for coaches to be able to have and demonstrate. So yeah, and then I think as the coach, you can help your staff by creating environments where they have to do things with constraints. They have to do things under pressure. They have to execute. And, you know, one thing we would do for players as the staff was when we would play our small-sided games, we always carried these sticks, call them the realistics. And they're like these lightweight, padded, you know, Gobert arms, some players call them. And some days we just say, yeah, players aren't winning today. They're not winning today. This is a coach's day. We're blocking everything. We're poking at your dribble. We're deflecting passes. We're blocking shots that nobody in the world could block, but too bad. This is what we're doing. And we're going to play as hard as we can so that we can force you to lose a game. And those were almost always the most fun days. The players tried the hardest. And a lot of times they'd lose and then they'd be itching to get back at it the next day because we'd talk trash. Yeah, players couldn't do anything with us today. Players can't score when we're really trying. And they just can't wait to get back the next day to prove you wrong. And the other thing we would do within some of these games is we'd have coaches create situations. So it might be a 9-9 game and I might foul somebody and say, okay, it's a side out of bounds, 7 seconds left. And give a coach a clipboard and say, go ahead, coach. You got 3 players. Figure out a late game play. And so now an assistant coach who hasn't been in this position, maybe he's got the whiteboard and he's got to drop a play under some pressure with these players around him. And we see, how does he communicate? Did he present information in a concise way, in a way that the players could understand? Was the plan any good? Was he prepared? You know, and then coaches are in their office after, you know, figuring out what their next 3-on-3 late game play is going to be. What are they going to use the next time their opportunity comes? And so kind of having that little bit of, it's a little bit of fun. It's a little bit of spontaneity. It's a little bit of things aren't always the same because, again, back to range, we want these wicked environments. We want things that aren't perfect, that we're not always prepared for. And then you do it and then you learn from what comes out of it.
Coach, I'd like to ask a question from a skill development standpoint, more specifically bench play, developing coming off the bench, whether you're a bench scorer, but coming in the game and adding value to the game and also being concentrated and you get in the game and you're engaged right away.
Yeah, that's a great question too. That reminds me of that article that they talked about Steve Kerr working with Chip England, and Kerr was only getting a couple of shots a game. So they sat down and read the newspaper, and he'd only take 4 or 5 shots in a workout, but he'd have to hop up and run in and take the shot. And then that was it. They'd have to sit back down for another 5, 6 minutes. And we tried to do that without as much of the spacing, more interleaving different skills like that, you know, in between water breaks with guys, we'd have them sit down and they'd have to come out and we'd say, all right, we're doing a need three and the play's for you. You know, this is the play. We draw it up. And then with the coaches that we had available, we'd execute the play and he'd get one chance at making, you know, we'd say it's 197, 7 seconds left. Just creating, again, these little situations and games where you just went from working out, you sat down, you got your drink of water, you're thinking you're just done or you're going to just go back into maybe shooting some spots. And now all of a sudden it's a relatively high stakes situation, you know, a fabricated situation. The other thing that I think we did a really good job of was just making sure the guys are in a position where they feel really confident about their feel and their conditioning. So it's not as much of the psychological of I'm sitting on the bench and the game starts and then I enter the game and I have to be ready to play. It was, do these guys feel like they have a good feel for the game? Because a bench player may not have consistent minutes. He may not know when he's going in the game. He may not play every game. So making sure that those guys were conditioning to the level of the minutes they wanted to play. So I would ask the player, how many minutes do you want to play in a game? And most of them will say, I want to play 30 to 35 minutes. So I'd say, okay, well, you play 15 minutes. So if you want to play, you average 15 minutes a game. You played 15 minutes last night or 2 nights ago. So before we play, because you're only playing 15 minutes, we're going to condition you so that you are going to get 35 minutes worth of workload today. So at 4 o'clock, you're playing at 7:30 tonight, but at 4 o'clock, we're going to come over to the gym and we're going to play 5-on-5 full court with constraints. And after you get done with that session, you're going to be a little fatigued because you just did it. You did a little bit of a workout. In 3 hours, you're going to be ready to play your 15 minutes. And then if the opportunity comes where you're needed to play more minutes, you are going to be psychologically prepared because you're going to know the amount of work that you've been putting in and you're going to feel conditioned. You're actually going to feel like you can withstand the effort necessary to play more minutes at that same level of intensity. So really that's what I try to do with guys that either were playing not a lot of minutes or weren't playing at all. We just played. We played on game days, you know, 3-4 hours before every game. So when their time was called, they thought, man, I've been killing in the stay in shape league. You know, I'm averaging 25 a game there. I'm ready to play. And so it kind of just gives you that little boost of, I feel good about where I am. But also to your point, especially working with the players I worked with during COVID doing the visualizations, guys that came off the bench wanted to go through sitting on the bench, what to look for in the game, you know, giving them little cues. And that's in the book as well, as giving guys things to look at that are based on their skill development objectives. So maybe it's a guy playing off the catch and you say, hey, Kenrich, I want you to watch in the first quarter or the first 5 minutes how guys receive the ball. See if anybody plays off the catch and what techniques they use. I'm going to ask you at halftime about it. And so now I'm giving him a different way to see the game, because a lot of players they love basketball. They love watching, but they don't always know what they're looking for. And that's why they really love being around people that can coach them and guide them, because they want to learn. They want to know what the coaches are seeing, what we're valuing, what they're being evaluated on. And a lot of times you're just watching, but you don't have those cues.
We'd like to shift a little bit to some technical stuff. And the first one is guarding the ball. You know, you always hear that guy's a great on-ball defender or this guy can really lock up. But with switching and pick and roll coverages. I mean, how valuable is it to have a guy that can really hawk the ball or stay in front of it?
I think it's hugely important. That ability for a guy to lock in on one player in the NBA that's so dominated by your team's best player touching the ball on every possession down the stretch. I think if you have a guy that can make those possessions difficult and tilt the advantage of the level of efficiency of the shots that you're getting versus what they're getting, I think it's, I mean, everyone runs pick and roll on every play. Everyone runs the same system. So if you can defeat screens, now if your big maybe isn't the greatest pick and roll defender, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think that's been from coaching Drew Holiday, watching how much better his individual greatness on the ball made other people was really remarkable. You might not be the best defender in support of him. He didn't need help all that often. And he could really make you run your offense from different spots of the floor that you weren't used to. He could make you really uncomfortable in your go-to moves or getting to your spots. I think that it can be really, really beneficial. The other interesting thing about the NBA defensively is the lack of ball pressure, is that no one pressures the ball. And it's very much a compact, let's pack it in, let's conserve our energy defensively. For me, that's frustrating just because it doesn't make sense to me why you wouldn't take away time and space from players. And it doesn't add up that nobody does it. You know, it's almost no one. There's no team that really pressures the ball, really gets into you. You know, when you see guys do it, they stand out. Like when Patrick Beverley or Corey Joseph or one of these guys actually picks up full court and actually gets into you and defeats screens, and it's just like, wow, like you must not be able to do that. You know, it's just like, it's jarring because it's so out of the ordinary in the NBA.
You talked a little about Drew Holiday being good at taking away a player's primary move or making them run their offense from a different spot on the floor. So what were sort of the things you were picking up that allowed him to do that, to kind of dictate to the offense where to go or what move to do?
That's such a great question. So especially when this thing got locked down and we started doing the visualizations, one of the players I was working with, Jahlil Okafor, big man, not known for his defense, super self-aware, mature, hardworking, like the best player I've ever worked with in terms of his mindset. So he says, I have to get better defensively. Let's study Drew. So I said, okay, that's a great idea. I love that because modeling behavior is like one of the best ways to teach, finding a model that does the things you want to do well, and let's lock in and let's try and see what we can learn. And I'll send it to you guys after. I made a video of Drew Holiday of exactly this, of his defensive technique. We looked and what I saw was, there's two things. One, the idea of a deep defensive stance. And this is something I had taught for years. The Patrick Beverley, you've seen Michael Jordan in this pose. It's the like crouched over, like I call it a flat back, but it's like the shortstop pose. It's the tennis player pose. I used to call it the universal athletic position. So that's all I'd ever taught, is that to defend, you need to get low. That's the key. Low man wins. You're quicker when you're lower. Yeah, I was wrong about that because it depends. It depends. Yes, if you're Patrick Beverley, if you're 6'1", you may be quicker lower. But when you're Jahlil Okafor and you're 7'1", 270, is getting lower making him quicker? And so I started to watch all these big people with Drew. After I watched Drew, I watched Ben Simmons, Anthony Davis, all these guys with great defensive reputations, and I just looked at their stance. How are they standing when they're guarding the ball? Are they super low? And none of them are. They're all generally, they're bent, but it's more about, to me, what your feet are doing. And so what Drew does is he floats. So both of his feet come up off the ground simultaneously, and he just kind of floats from place to place when he's engaged on the ball. It's like a dance. We call it the float step because if you pause it, both of his feet are off the ground at the same time. And it's not much, it's just a little bit, but it's just this constant resetting of his feet. And all that's doing is priming him for movement. And so then once you're beat, the thing that I always taught. Step slide. Slide your outside foot, drag your other foot. But none of these guys do that either. Now, sometimes they do that. Sometimes you can keep the ball square. You use your chest and you keep sliding. Clay does a great job of it. There's a bunch of guys that utilize it a lot, but they all also utilize the crossover step. And so when you're beat and you need to make up space, if you slide, you're dead. And so the defensive slide, to say that this is the only way that you move defensively, is to show that you have never looked at the best defenders in the way that they actually move their bodies, because they all swivel their hips, turn their shoulders, and run to the next spot. And then once they get there, they try and get back in front. And so we just looked at these things and we said, wow, maybe, you know, Marc Gasol is not getting into a defensive stance. And he's a similar body, you know, type. He's a big fella. He would get in this, I call it the DB stance, where he would kind of like crouch like a DB, but he wasn't like getting low. He was up high, just kind of like with a bent knee. And he would just backpedal with his arms out, and he was cutting down passing lanes. He was cutting down attack angles. He was keeping the man in front of him at a depth that was comfortable to him. And the thing Jahlil told me was, the thing he's taking most is that now I feel comfortable doing movements that are comfortable to me, not what my coaches have been telling me for 10 years are the way that defense is played. And so, you know, that was really the, to me, the greatest realization of going through these things and looking deeper into it and just opening up the lines of communication with a player, really, where he asked to go into a technique. We studied it together. He noticed things. I noticed things. We kind of had a beginner's mind. Okay, I'm not going to say that the things I've always taught are right. I'm going to look at this and see if there's other ways to do it. And I think we found that there was another way to do it that was probably more beneficial to him.
That's great stuff. Another kind of follow-up is, are you noticing anything that they do with their hands with a live dribble? Was Jrue Holiday doing anything with what hand he's reaching or hawking the ball? Is there anything different that maybe that probably hasn't already been taught?
Two things come to mind when you say that. One is Jahlil brought to me his intention to stab at the ball handler when the ball leaves his hand. Instead of stabbing when the ball's in control of my hand and I feint at you and I have control, so I'm not going to be as dissuaded as I am if I don't have control of the ball and you feint at me. And so I thought that was a very minor detail that I found really interesting. As for Jrue, the thing most players take from him after playing with him or against him is he loves to go for the steal across your body. So instead of, if you have the ball in your left hand, instead of him going with his right hand, when you drive, he turns his shoulders and reaches with his left hand. It's an unorthodox way of doing it. It's definitely a bit of a gamble, because if the guy's able to somehow change directions, you know, you're going to be really out of position. But not many people get out of this. So if you're driving and he's kind of on your hip, instead of him reaching across with his right hand, he's going to go in with his left hand to poke the ball out. You'll see it in the video I send you. He has a steal on Siakam, exactly what I'm talking about.
Coach, we'd like to transition now to our overrated, underrated segment. So for overrated, underrated, we'll just give you the topic. You tell if it's overrated or underrated, a little reason why, and we'll just have a little fun with it.
All right.
Okay, so number one, just a kind of fun one for you to start. Overrated or underrated, the shooting sleeve?
The shooting sleeve is underrated. Very underrated. Yeah.
Okay.
Allen Iverson wore the sleeve, and I had a wall of his posters up in my childhood bedroom. So the sleeve is iconic, underrated. I mean, more players need to wear the sleeve. I mean, it's a no-brainer. That's like the ultimate style. That's the Jordan leg sleeve for me, is the Iverson sleeve.
How much does it increase a guy's shooting percentage?
Oh, 0%. When he puts the sleeve on. No impact whatsoever.
All right. Coach, my overrated, underrated, form shooting.
It's underrated. Yeah, everyone does it. The best shooters, Steph Curry, J.J. Redick, Ray Allen. I've worked with all the best shooters ever, besides Larry Bird. Klay Thompson, They all start right next to the basket, getting their form, watching it splash through, controlling their wrist tempo, whatever it is that they're thinking about, they start in close. So the best of the best do it. I don't understand how anybody that wants to be a good shooter doesn't start by doing it.
And are they doing form shooting how you would think, with one hand, or are they still putting the guide hand on the ball?
You know, they do both. I'd say a lot of them start with the one hand.
Okay. And from all spots on the court?
I mean, like JJ does a little smile, does a little circle, you know, a half circle around the rim. Clay used to just work his way back. Clay would start at the front of the rim and just work his way kind of progressively back, further, 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 free throw all the way out to three. That's how he started.
Coach, with simple shooting form and teaching guys to shoot, what's your thoughts on keeping your eyes on the rim throughout the whole shot, or guys that shoot it and then kind of look up at the ball?
Yeah, that's so unconscious that I don't really think much about it. I think that the best players,
okay,
Steph Curry follows the ball. People do it both ways.
Yeah. I know I needed to follow it because I needed to know where it was going to miss off the rim so I could get the rebound. So. All right, Joe, overrated or underrated catching in a triple threat position?
Overrated. Yeah, the way that I want to play, there's almost never a triple threat position. I think you should be meeting every pass on the move. So for me, the principle is space is away from the pass. So again, it's not always the case, but dealing in probabilities and not possibilities, as a pass comes to you, the likelihood is that the space is away from you. So I want you moving towards the ball, and then I want you catching it and using the momentum of ripping away from where that pass came from to attack. So either you're on the move catching and you're open and you're shooting, or you're catching, swinging it, or you're catching and ripping away from where the pass came from. So those are the three things I want you to be thinking about, but I want you on the move, and you can't be in the triple threat and be moving. So yeah, I mean, it's good for if you're under pressure and combating that, but for the way I want to play, the ball is never being held. So, you know, I think that there's a problem if you're in the triple threat for the most part with the offense. You better be dealing with some serious ball pressure to assume the triple threat position. For me, I want the ball moving more quickly than a triple threat would allow.
When you're telling them to catch on the move, so are they catching on the move and then with the jump stop and then going, or is it like a 1-2? Does it matter? Is there any sort of teaching point there?
I would lean towards the 1-2 with your inside foot, probably like coming up, following the pass and catching. Yeah. But I love hopping into a shot. I think that gives you like incredible rhythm and timing when you can coordinate off of 2 feet to shoot. So again, if I'm working with a player and I notice that he's doing one or the other, then I may prime him to do the other, just so that, again, he's comfortable when it doesn't happen the way that he wants to happen in a game, when he catches it on a hop, or he is always hopping and he catches it off of a 1-2. I want to be Navy SEALs, able to just go into any situation and be effective.
Overrated, underrated as a tactic, posting your guards.
This is a tough one because I'm going to go with both of these. Okay. It's overrated posting to score anyone. That's overrated. But it's underrated posting as a playmaker, because you're so close to the basket and it's a unique pattern. So you get so many good things out of the post as when you don't look to score. I mean, the scariest thing to me is Jokic standing 5 feet from the rim, where he could throw it in over either shoulder if he wants, but he also can dime a cutter, or he can throw it to the guy filling behind the cutter who's got his feet set and he's outside the three-point line. Obviously, Jokic is a big, but you know, the skill sets of Jokic, not a lot of guards have, but more guards have than bigs have. So I think putting those guys in that position where they're the trigger man for your action, I think is underrated. I think you can get a lot of really great offense out of the post as long as you have the mentality that I'm posting to create for other people rather than to create for myself.
Why do you think we don't see that as much with guards in the NBA? Are those discussions in coaching circles about trying to do that more often?
Yeah, I think posting up to most NBA people is a very common play type of the past of scoring. And so that's how it's still associated. You would only post to score. Now, they'll steal an ATO from Quinn Snyder or throw it into the post and run some down screens for a shooter. You see that a lot out of timeout now. But for the most part, I think they want to leverage their highest efficiency play types. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at the efficiency of the NBA and you see what pick and rolls get versus other play types, that doesn't seem to be the case. Pick and roll doesn't seem to be more efficient than a lot of other types of plays, yet it's still the most prevalent. So that kind of debunks that theory. But that's the only thing I can think of, is that they are just like, spread pick and roll is the hardest thing to guard in the game. Let's just maximize our possessions that teams have to defend this, because I don't know.
Last one for you here, Coach. Overrated or underrated AAU basketball?
Oh, man. I never played AAU. I wasn't very good, and it wasn't like I was going to get a scholarship, so it wasn't that big of a deal. I would tie it all the way back into range and say, as long as it's a part of a bigger picture of what basketball players are doing in their off seasons, I think that the range of young athletes, not only in problem solving and playing different games and, you know, having a breadth of experience that can inform decisions within your specialty, is very important. And then also just the pounding and the repeated explosive movements, and the, you know, when you end up being exposed to the same explosive movements over and over and over again, the wear and tear that happens, you know, to a lot of young athletes by doing that, is something to be mindful of. I don't want to crush AAU just because I don't really know much about it, but I would say, I would hope that it's not the only thing that basketball players are doing in the summer. I'd hope that they're playing other sports and developing other hobbies and doing other things that, you know, ultimately will help serve them later on, these general experiences that end up, you know, being important in what you do down the line.
Coach, to follow up on that, and I guess in your opinion, or maybe just talking with other NBA players, are there other sports or hobbies you would encourage a young athlete to do that you feel translates well to the basketball?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about that. Most NBA players, I'm trying to think what if any of the multi-sport athletes that I, you know, or guys that, what have they ever said? Oh, I've taken this from this or that.
I know, like, Kobe did kickboxing and stuff, right, in the off season, things like that. Like,
I definitely could see that. The thing I would like is maybe like some type of martial arts, maybe some type of like mind body connection, where it's, you know, it has kind of, it's attached to a greater purpose. You know, I know boxing guys love boxing workouts too in the off season. I did it once when I was in Golden State. Oh, it was brutal. My shoulders were so sore. I was exhausted. Whole new respect for the training that's necessary for that. But yeah, I would love for them to try some Muay Thai or some karate or jiu-jitsu or something like that. I think that there'd be a huge benefit from that. There's a great book called Thinking Body, Dancing Mind that goes into that. And it kind of talks about how the practice of some of these ancient arts can be beneficial in all types of different things that you do.
Well, Coach, you're off the overrated, underrated hot seat. Thank you. So as we kind of wrap up the podcast, first of all, thank you very much for your time and for your thoughts.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. Awesome questions.
To finish, looking at your overall whole career, what's one of the best investments that you've made in your career as a coach?
I think that really one of the most important things has been getting to know the players as people. I've had the greatest fulfillment out of that when you build that special bond with another person where they know you have their best interest at heart. You're doing whatever you can to help them reach their goals, and they in turn believe in you and the things that you're doing. That's pushed me to greater heights, I think, than anything else. That's made me want to keep learning the newest techniques, the newest philosophies, which are often the oldest philosophies, but just constantly trying to refine my approach, constantly trying to learn and say, we're going to do things differently this year, because if we didn't, that would mean I haven't learned or grown as a coach over the past 12 months. So setting that standard of wanting to give the best service possible to a person that you connect to and you really want the best for. So it's that saying that you don't coach a sport, you coach a person. I'm a basketball coach, but it's been the relationships for sure that have been the most fulfilling and the most beneficial thing that I've done so far in my career.
Yeah, that's great.
I want to actually ask you one follow-up and circle back on something you said very beginning of the podcast. You mentioned that when you were younger, you would be the guy that would, you know, punt the ball and talk trash and, you know, kind of screw up the game and all that. What do you do now as a coach when you see those kinds of behaviors or that mentality in a younger guy that you coach? How do you handle that, knowing that's who you were yourself when you were younger? What do you do with that player now to help them?
Yeah, I mean, I just try and put them in the situations, because you learn by doing. And I know that me telling them not to fuss at the refs, my dad told me that, you know, for 22 years, he told me, stop talking to the refs. It's not helping. And I'd say, I got you, Dad. And then I couldn't stop. So I know that the best advice means very little. It has to be practiced. So I try and bring awareness to it. I try and show them on film what they look like. I say, how does this benefit you? And how does this benefit the team? Look at your reaction. And now look at the chain reaction that comes. Now look at your four teammates. Look what they do. Yep. Two more of them threw their hands up. How is our group right now? What's our focus level? Where is our attention at? And it's a result of what you did. So you're leading, whether you want to or not, by example. What example do you want to set? Do you want to prepare yourself to be best in the next possession? And do you want to have your whole group on board? Do you want to lead your group in a positive way? If you don't, then we don't have to keep looking at this. We don't have to keep working on this. I won't bring it up again. If you don't care, if you get better, if your team plays well, then there's no reason to keep doing this. But if you do, every time you lose your emotional control, I'm going to bring it up. We're going to watch it. We're going to have to sit with that, is what you did. And then we're going to have a situation where I'm going to push your buttons out there during a small-sided game. I'm going to change the score. I'm going to cheat you. I'm going to make some bad calls, and I'm playing against you. And I'm still talking trash, because now I have a purpose to do it, because it serves a purpose. It's not I'm playing the inner game and the outer game. So I can do both because I have awareness. And then we're going to try and get better at it. So yeah, I'm hyper aware of it, because I know it's a weakness of mine. It's something that I have to continue to work on, because my brother just crushed me in one-on-one. I challenged him for the family championship and he beat me. Like, it was brutal. He just bagged me down, scored like five in a row. And then he hit like six threes in a row. He blew me out, and I punched the ball, and I'm just like, no, I lost it. But it still happens. I'm a work in progress. So, I mean, it helps me again, keep that beginner's mind of, okay, even the best intentioned people, even people with practice, are still going to lose their emotional control at times. And that's okay. And that's not a reflection of me or them. It's just another step along the journey that we're making together. And so let's address it. Let's watch it. Let's make an intention to be better. And then let's create an environment where we can practice.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe to our newsletter for additional insights on this podcast. Have a great week, coaching, and we'll see you next time on Slapping Glass.